You're listening to CKMS News on CKMS 102.7 FM in Waterloo, Ontario, radiowaterloo.ca on the web. This program is part of a local journalism initiative grant program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access recordings of this show on radiowaterloo.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism website, which is nmc-mic.ca/lji. Or just go to Google and search Local Journalism Initiative website. I'm your host, Trish Holmes, and you can find me on Twitter at Mr. Darling. The housing crisis is a complex issue affecting every strata of society. Costs greatly exceed wages, and supply is insufficient, and so because demand and costs are high, access and availability are at record lows. Waterloo Region has a relatively wealthy and often transient population. Migration and city growth are estimated to be among the highest in Canada, and much of this growth has been directed to help these new populations. If I said these words a few years ago, I would have talked about specific populations who struggle with their search for housing. But the housing crisis has ballooned to such a problem that it doesn't affect just one group anymore. And because that's true, obtaining housing is that much harder for people who live in poverty. Last week, I had the good fortune to interview Martin Asling about the housing and affordability crisis in Waterloo Region. Martin is one of the founders of YIMBY, which stands for Yes in My Backyard, a housing advocacy group that promotes increasing housing supply and affordability through the densification of cities. Martin also sits on Kitchener's Housing Strategy Committee. Thank you, Martin, for agreeing to talk to me today. If you want to say a few words about yourself or about your advocacy group.
Yeah, so my name is Martin Asling. Melissa Bowman and I, we formed a group called Waterloo Region Yes in My Backyard. So we're advocating for more housing overall. We're particularly interested and focused on more affordable housing. And we're also broadly in favor of other measures to make housing more affordable, whether that, you know, subsidies or some other kind of government measure to make housing more affordable. I think that what we need to do is pretty broadly based. Like the housing crisis that we're faced with has a lot of different causes to it, and I think it would require a lot of different solutions. And one of the things I'm always trying to stress is that different solutions aren't necessarily in opposition to each other. And sometimes we talk about them as if they are, but that's not necessarily the case. I think often the different types of solutions, so for example, allowing for more housing overall, that might be called more housing density. Ultimately, that's allowing more people into, you know, neighborhoods that they may choose to go into. They certainly have a greater element of choice. Of course, the cost of housing will still be a barrier, but we think it would be less of a barrier if you allow for particularly more multi-dwelling kind of homes, more apartment buildings, townhomes, that kind of thing. We're also particularly concerned about a bylaw stipulating that lodging homes need to be 400 meters apart from each other, except for in a very kind of core zone of Kitchener.
Was YIMBY formed in response to Kitchener changing the zoning laws last year?
I think that certainly played a role, like the what's called the Crosby process, mm-hmm. You know. I think that certainly played a role. It certainly made me think more about zoning as a local issue should be of concern. I don't think it was strictly speaking in response to that. We are Waterloo Region, yes, in my backyard, which means that even though, like, zoning, you know, each individual city kind of has its own zoning, although that's kind of affected by the regional official plan as well, despite the fact that it is kind of localized to each city, you know, we are kind of a community together. And I think one of the big kind of YIMBY principles is that one of the dangers of localizing our thinking is that itself can be exclusionary. One of the kind of debates we got into was whether or not we should be speaking about a development that some people feel that you should just speak about a development if it's in your neighborhood. But the problem with that is that excludes people that might want to live in that neighborhood. And there's a good thing about trying to localize activism in the sense that, you know, the further people have to go and they're thinking, or even just traveling or whatever, the easier it is to do advocacy and activism. But if you're defining it, one of the house divided quotes that we had on our Facebook page was just talking about how we should really think of communities as not exclusionary things that we need to have strict boundaries around, but something that where we should be like thinking about how we can invite others into our communities and make them accessible for people.
Is there any way to demand inclusion of affordable housing in residential buildings, maybe through inclusionary zoning laws?
We don't have inclusionary zoning yet.
Right.
So basically, if any of those units are affordable, I mean, if they're new units, they're newer units are more likely than not more expensive. And there are, I believe, some measures at the region where you could subsidize housing to make it more likely to be affordable. However, inclusionary zoning is not that kind of pressure to get developers to make housing more affordable is not there yet. And that's one of the things that's being discussed at the city of Kitchener.
Kitchener is trying to increase the supply with the tiny houses initiative. How do you feel about that?
Overall, I think that that's a positive. The one caution that I would make if people are too quick to be excited about that is that there are a lot of different ways that the city of Kitchener or any city affects supply, and that's one small way that it could affect supply. So I think that we need to keep paying attention to what the city of Kitchener is doing, and kind of the next stage where they're kind of looking at the neighborhood level zoning, that has been delayed because of COVID. But that's something that we're going to have to really pay attention to when that comes up again, in particular because one of the things that's really important to us is it's not just like the overall supply of housing, which I've probably said a million times, but also the distribution of where we allow housing. So one of the, if you don't mind a little bit of a tangent, since I mentioned the next stage of the Crosby, if you go online to the city of Kitchener Crosby, you can kind of see more details about that. The next kind of engagements, I believe, are still to be determined because of COVID. But looking at things at a neighborhood level is kind of problematic because there's the problem that we see is not just lack of supply overall, but just that we allow it in certain areas and we allow much less dense housing in other areas. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, first of all, a lot of concerns about gentrification come in. And that's where a lot of also concerns, I think, another thing that we need to be talking about at the same time when we talk about gentrification is segregation. So if Richard Rothstein wrote a book called The Color of Law. It's about racism, institutional racism in the United States.
Okay.
And it's a very difficult read for a lot of reasons, and not all of it relates to our conversation right now, at least directly, but a lot of it deals with institutional racism in housing. And one of the points that was brought up, and there are all kinds of, you know, you may know a bit about redlining, maybe about the racist racial covenants, where white families often, you know, had this kind of covenant where they weren't allowed to sell to black families, and down the line, all these different ways to discriminate against black people and black families. But ultimately, when those more explicitly racist measures were less feasible politically, often what came about was what is called exclusionary zoning, which is the crux of what we're about, which is, you know, zoning to keep people out. And when you're zoning to say this neighborhood shouldn't have more dense housing, you're essentially zoning to keep people out. And if you read Richard Rothstein's book, or if you read maybe some of the stuff that Ta-Nehisi Coates has said, because that's directly online, about the case for reparations, which is really just talking about all the different ways that African Americans were, you know, not just disadvantaged, but actively discriminated against by their governments. One of the key areas that was just kind of institutionalized when the other things were no longer feasible was the idea that this neighborhood shouldn't be allowed to have dense housing, it shouldn't be allowed to have apartment buildings, and that kind of thing. And when you already have these great disparities in wealth based on past institutional racism, then that just further institutionalized by creating what's, directly a class kind of segregation, mm-hmm. Further institutionalized the racial segregation. And the point that Jamelle Bruie made in another webinar, I was fortunate enough to listen to it. So Jamelle Bruie, he writes for the New York Times, if you want to hear his thoughts on segregation then and now. But basically, the point that he made is that even if now racism is not a motivation in our zoning laws, the fundamental thing is that if you're calling for different amounts of densification in different neighborhoods. That means you have different types of affordability in different neighborhoods, especially over the longer run, where, yeah, certainly newer buildings are more expensive, but all else being equal over the long run, you know, the more dense buildings, even townhouses, but particularly apartment buildings, are more likely to be inexpensive. Single detached homes are more likely to be expensive, you know, for fairly obvious reasons. They're more spacious and they have these big yards and everything. That leads to a kind of class segregation. And if you have, and of course, class segregation can kind of reinforce whatever other kind of inequalities you have in society. So I think that it's really important to have these kind of conversations, not just at the neighborhood level, but at the entire city level. Because ultimately, you know, if people in one neighborhood are saying, well, we don't want housing, too much housing here, you have to really force people to address the reality that if you're saying you don't want housing here, you're ultimately saying you don't want people here. And then, but then where do people go? Are you ultimately saying we don't want people here, we want people there? But if you're having that conversation just at that neighborhood level, then it's almost like the structure of how you're having that conversation allows people to not even really think about it. Because we're just talking about this neighborhood now. We'll talk about that neighborhood next month, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that these are the kind of things that we really have to talk about on a broader kind of scale.
Is that what you mean by people zoning?
People zoning in particular, the Ontario Human Rights Commission uses that phrase to describe zoning that is specifically about people and trying to limit what might be called the concentration of poverty, the concentration of poor people, essentially. So we specifically use that phrase with regards to the minimum separation distance bylaw, because that's the phrase that the Ontario Human Rights Commission uses when it comes to the lodging houses. Because in that case, it's much more explicit, because, you know, the idea is that you don't want to concentrate poverty, right? But mm-hmm. that's ultimately saying you don't want to concentrate low-income people, which is much more explicitly people zoning, because that's the idea behind it, like determining where people can go. I would kind of argue that, like, when it comes to the other things, like, say, with apartment buildings, with, like, height restrictions, it's a bit more complex because, you know, people make other arguments about tall buildings. You know, they don't want shadows, for example. Mm-hmm. It might not be about people specifically or perceived characteristics of people, but it might be about traffic. Now, we disagree with those arguments. I think that particularly with traffic, if you want to limit traffic overall, you really need more dense housing. Right, because that allows for more walkability, for more, it makes transit more feasible, etc. You know, you're closer to work, essentially. And I would argue that I think effectively it often is a form of people zoning, because not wanting too many people in a particular neighborhood, I think, ultimately is what a lot of it comes down to. But I think it's less of a direct line, so I'm not as comfortable saying explicitly that it's people zoning like I would for, say, the lodging house bylaw. But I think that perhaps there's an element of it there, mm-hmm. Just in the thinking, and that's one of the reasons that we're opposed to these things. But yeah, so that's kind of, so we use people zoning in that particular sense, and also because the Ontario Human Rights Commission uses that term to describe minimum separation distance bylaws for lodging houses and other jurisdictions. It could also be, say, group homes or that kind of thing.
In case you just joined us, you are listening to CKMS News. My name is Trish Holmes, and I'm talking with Martin Asling of the Yes in My Backyard Housing Advocacy Group, and we're discussing the housing and affordability crisis in Waterloo Region.
You were thinking of maybe kind of talking about COVID as it relates to, say, overcrowding, which I think, if maybe I could kind of start now, but that's kind of where I'll go. I am concerned about overcrowding, of course. So I disagree with, you know, using a kind of regulation to say that you can't have lodging houses within a certain, new lodging houses within a certain distance from another lodging house, because ultimately, while I am concerned with overcrowding, I see that as a problem of poverty. It's not a problem of, you know, we need to ultimately regulate the small amount of choices that poor people already have. I think if you have a problem with overcrowding, you need to do something about poverty so that people can afford other options that may be available. And one of the kind of debates, there has been kind of some kind of pushback due to COVID with density, right? And one of the, there's a really important, I think, meme that has kind of gone around, which is saying that overcrowding and density aren't necessarily the same thing. to do something about poverty itself. So we need to make more housing available. If you limit the amount of lodging houses, the alternative doesn't then magically sprout up. You know, people that if you can't go to a legal housing to a legal lodging house because it doesn't exist, you might go to an illegal lodging house that has less regulation. You might be on the street, which would put you even more at risk to COVID and other issues because, you know, you're not able to really isolate yourself and you're not able to take care of your health to the same extent. It might put you in a shelter, which is more likely to be overcrowded. And thankfully, you know, the Charles Street Men's Shelter was able to move to the Radisson during COVID. But, you know, I mean, that overcrowding has always kind of been a problem in shelters. And that's because people don't have other options. The alternative, particularly when it's a problem of poverty, is to make other options available for people. And then the other thing is that what COVID has shown, it's certainly made a very dire situation even more dire for people that are on the streets. And I think that there's a lot of very good activism in our community. The Alliance Against Poverty and the Social Development Center have been working very hard, and we've been trying to help where we can as well, at least in terms of like sharing information and calls for donations and things like that, because it's really important, in particular now, that we have other options for people, allow people to self-isolate. And I think it's incredible that when a crisis hits, we can find other things. You know, we find that now people can stay at the Radisson. Now we have a Better Tent City, which is being formed. We have all these great initiatives. So I think a couple of things that I would say about that, because while COVID makes it much more dire, I mean, the problems of homelessness were always here. There were always significant health problems because of the homelessness that we allow in our communities and the overcrowding in shelters. That has always been a problem. And I hope that the kind of community spirit that we've shown in trying to do something about that now hopefully can carry over even when this pandemic is hopefully taken care of, because the problem of homelessness will still be around. The dire health consequences of homelessness will still be around. I mean, there's always going to be the risk of the next pandemic as well. But even beyond that, there's always been huge dire health consequences for people that are experiencing and suffering the consequences of homelessness.
That's really interesting, and almost as if necessity is the mother of invention. How would you define affordability?
Well, I think when you're looking at how you define affordability, I think that it's really important to pin down when you're talking about, say, like a very specific kind of government initiative to make housing affordable, whether it's inclusionary zoning, whether it's subsidies to lessen the cost of housing, how affordable are you really making it? And one of the criticisms that we shared on our page was that if you use this kind of market-based measure of affordability, like say like average market rent or something, well, what if market rent is skyrocketing? Then it becomes less and less relevant or useful as a measure. But the other point that I would make about that is that affordability isn't just something that we can affect it in different ways, right? We can affect it by actively subsidizing in different ways, or we also affect it through our zoning. And the way we affect it through our zoning is like when we force neighborhoods to have lower density housing, you know, that lowers the supply, and overall that's more likely than not going to raise prices. But it's not as if there's this really neat formula where you can figure out exactly how much is going to raise prices, or exactly how much adding housing is going to lower prices. Or unfortunately, sometimes because there's a lot else going on, sometimes the standard is at least it's rising at a lower rate, which is a small victory at least. And like I'm saying, there's a lot more you need to deal with. So I think when we talk about what's affordable, I would prefer to talk about actual people's needs when it's affordability that we have greater control over. But I also think we have to consider that adding more housing overall is necessary as well to ease the affordability crisis, but it's not a clear-cut question of how much more affordable it would become. You know, that's something that's how the market might respond to things, and we can't say that with certainty, but the best evidence that I've seen is that it makes it, it is much more likely to make housing more affordable than it would otherwise be.
I always thought affordability had to do with the idea of core housing need, that it's not overcrowded, that it's the unit doesn't need substantial repairs, and that the percent of income is less than 30%. I thought that how affordability was defined.
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't actually actually meaning to contradict that at all. Different people have different definitions, so I think that that's a better definition if you're relating it to people's income. I think that's more useful than talking about how some others have talked about it as a certain percentage of market prices, because one of the problems is that the cost of so-called market housing is very expensive right now, right? When I was trying to make about that, right. As well as when we want to make housing more affordable, we're also saying that more housing overall will more often than not have a downward pressure on prices, and that's a good thing, but it's not. So sometimes people might make the argument that a new housing development isn't affordable, so we shouldn't have it. But then you have to think of, well, what's the actual, or not really that we shouldn't have it, so maybe it shouldn't be as tall as it is or something. But if anything, that will make it even less affordable. So that's kind of the thing that we have to struggle with. But absolutely, like when you're talking about the issue of affordability, you have to look at the core housing need first. I mean, I think that's certainly where the government resources need to go.
I see that there's 14 residential towers being built in Kitchener, but what controls are there to ensure that there is affordability?
So Connor Doherty wrote a book called Golden Gates, and I was lucky enough to view a webinar by him, hosted by another YIMBY group, and he made the point. So he's talking about how basically In his view, and he's one kind of YIMBY type person, and I think there's a spectrum of people that would identify as YIMBY, but his perspective is that rent control and increasing the supply of housing are two different things. And in his view, they're both necessary. Rent control is more of an immediate measure, right? Mm-hmm. So like if you increase the supply of, have measures to allow for the increase of supply of housing, well, first of all, the housing isn't going to just be created overnight. And second of all, the effect is often an overall effect on the price of housing. So it's important to have something kind of much more direct. So rent control is one example of that. Another would be the kind of subsidies that you can have for housing, whether that's building subsidized housing, whether that's the kind of subsidies that are more directly towards the tenant and their housing. And then the other part of it that's also necessary is that rent control, as well as subsidies, they don't address the broader, or I would say one of the broader important problems behind the increasing cost of housing, and that's this incredible demand that we have for housing, and that's not going to go away, and the supply that we have that is not doing a great job of matching that demand. So that's where increasing the amount of housing is maybe a medium term to longer term kind of strategy that's also really necessary. So I think that the question of increasing the supply by allowing for more dense housing, I think that's a very important part, both because that dense housing is more likely to be affordable itself. Like the single detached home is the most expensive, all else being equal, type of housing that there is, but also just the overall amount of housing will more likely than not lower the cost of housing. But that's not the entire story. That's not the only thing that we can and should do. So rent control is another option. I mean, some YIMBY groups are in favor, some not as much, but I think that we're, like, our group certainly is not opposed to rent control. I think rent control is an important component to making sure that landlords can't just jack up rent, you know, however which way they please. And of course, it's difficult trying to enforce that. I think it's also difficult when you have a shortage of housing, because then it can just kind of create, you know, even more incentive for turning another apartment building into a condo or something like that, or rent evictions or those kinds of things. I think that the other way that increasing supply can complement other measures is that it makes it kind of harder for, you know, landlords to do whatever they want. It puts another pressure on landlords to not be able to do whatever they want to get as much profit as they can get, because there's going to be other options for renters, and that's going to put a little bit more pressure on them as well. I see increasing the supply of housing as complementary to other approaches. I think we're very much in favor of subsidizing housing as well. I think that's very important, you know, for some of the reasons that Connor Doherty pointed out and others.
I just wanted to ask another question about supply. Now, this might, I might just be pulling this out of thin air, but just in reading, I've noticed that short-term rentals have a major impact on long-term rentals. The city of Kitchener doesn't collect any data on Airbnb. So I was wondering, do you have any sense of what, of the crisis with Airbnb or of how much impact Airbnb has had on the housing situation in Kitchener?
I'm very aware of that, of the existence of that argument, and while I haven't looked into it extensively, I'm fairly sympathetic to that concern because, yeah, you have all these short-term rentals, and that has been taking a lot of long-term rentals off the market, and that certainly affects the supply of long-term rentals. And I wish I could remember explicitly where, but there was people have kind of pointed out the effect on the cost of housing when Airbnb, like due to the pandemic, kind of Airbnb kind of just got utterly knocked out in a lot of cases. So that kind of led to changes in prices. Yeah, so I do think that that's something that people should be thinking about. That is something that people should be concerned with, absolutely.
Right, but Kitchener doesn't collect that data, is that right?
No, and that's something that Councillor Chapman has been inquiring about.
Well, you're doing an amazing job, Martin. You are so involved and you obviously are passionate about it and know so much. So thank you so much for everything you do.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for drawing attention to it. I would say that if anyone's interested in being involved, we are most active on Facebook, but we also have a virtual meeting the fourth Thursday of every month from 7 to 9. So you can get details on that, the Skype link through our Facebook page, and we also bring up agendas about a week beforehand. So if anyone's interested in getting involved about the things that we're talking about or kind of broadening the scope, you know, if you're willing to kind of put in the work to help get that done, then we're very happy to kind of be a hub for activism and to really advocate for the things that we're passionate about.
You're listening to CKMS. I'm Trish Holmes, and I've been speaking to Martin Asling of the Yes in My Backyard advocacy group about housing supply and density in Waterloo Region. This has been the CKMS Newsroom. You can check out archived versions of this program and other episodes on radiowaterloo.ca/news. You can also follow us on Twitter at Radio Waterloo. And you can email news@radiowaterloo.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover.